to the Cajun dance and the Zydeco. Filet gumbo and a crawfish pie.
Filet gumbo and a crawfish pie.
Welcome to Literary Gumbo, a continuing look at the world of writers, writing, publishing, and anything else we can piggyback along with that. My name is Fred Klein. I'm sort of the chief stirrer. I've been around in publishing for a number of years. And my guest today matches me, I think, in the number of years he's been around. Yeah. Been around almost every phase of show business, of using words to create something. My guest is Sid Stiebel. Welcome, Sid.
Thank you for
that. He's up here for the Santa Barbara Writers Conference, which we'll talk about in a little while.
Okay.
But let's go back. We met, I still think, like 40, 50 years ago. But I want to go back to your early period. Right. From, where were you born, for instance?
Sioux City, Iowa.
Sioux City, Iowa. Okay. You got out of there fast?
No, because my father was a merchant.
Yeah.
In a country town called Sioux Rapids, wonderful town, on a river. We got to run around the town pretty much on our own.
Uh-huh.
And in 1939, he decided it was time to move on. My mother had agitated. They were both immigrants from home.
Okay, so we're...
And they wanted to... my father had my uncle in as his brother was living in Van Nuys, California.
Van Nuys, California.
And my mother, who wanted to go to New York because she was very cultured, et cetera, et cetera.
So where'd you settle?
In California.
Okay.
Relatives always went out. And
so did you go to school there? And
I went to school. Wonderful schools in Iowa. It broke my heart to leave.
Oh.
I didn't want to leave.
Uh-huh.
And
have you ever been back? Local
once,
boy makes good?
What? No.
No?
No, I went back, and of all the people that I used to know, this, that, and the other, only one person seemed happy to see me. I'm paranoid, you know, like all of us. And she was a cleaning lady. Yeah, there were two families, and the town was a wonderful town, and the people in it were it was a farm community. Every harvest time, I was shipped out to friends of my family, the Olson family.
So then, how did you get into the habit of writing? Why did words?
I was a reader because I was a bumpkin.
Yeah.
And I loved to read. I loved words.
Yeah.
And also, I wanted to isolate myself from my family because of this small town, 394 people, something like that. The only two houses where you could ever hear anything going on were the Bohemians and the Jews. My father actually got his citizenship by, he fled to the Tsar's army. He was going to be drafted. He was 16. He went to Sweden, worked in a match factory. He really liked that.
Uh-huh.
And then he came to the States and worked on railroad gangs. And then signed up for World War I, and that's how he got his citizenship.
All right. But I'm going to go back to you. All right.
We've I'm proud of him.
Okay. So where'd you go to college? Where'd you go to, or did you go to college?
I did go to college.
You didn't go to college?
Absolutely went to college.
Please.
And I happened to...
In Van Nuys? No.
By then we were living in the Miracle Mile area of Los Angeles.
Okay.
And I went to a UCLA dance in the daytime. Yeah. They had jazz. This was jazz.
Just remember,
era.
We have only a half hour because I have a
okay.
view.
All
you're
right.
going to give
All right.
me. You're gonna,
All right. Well, just to sum it up.
Yeah.
Friend from high school showed up. He said, "Aren't you? You're a GI, right? Ex-GI. You get the GI Bill. Uh-huh. Yeah. Go somewhere expensive."
He takes
me to USC.
Oh.
And my life went on from there. I'm very involved with the university.
And where does Australia come in? Australia come in after you graduate?
Yeah, of course I graduated.
I said, after you graduate, is that when you go to Australia?
No, don't pin me down on years because I can't.
Oh, okay.
But it was 1970s, somewhere in there, late 60s to 70s.
But you went to Australia?
Yeah, only for a year and a half.
But what did you do there? You were judging.
I was the film script advisor for the South Australian Film Corporation.
Okay.
They had actually the first movie industry, but it was so cheap to buy TV and movies from the States and England stuff that they decided they wanted to create their own.
Oh.
So I met a guy at one of the lots, I think it was Fox, and he was a line producer, and he was looking at terrible films, figuring a way to save them. And when he heard my suggestions, he says, "You're really smart about fixing story and this, that, and the other thing." So he had just gotten a job as a producer. He did Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Okay.
Or he supervised Picnic at Hanging Rock. And I was a
I got a credit on it.
Okay.
But then you came back to the U.S.
Came back to the U.S.
And then you started, you've got a history of books, of TV shows, of screenplays. Which came first? Did you start with the screen? Since it sounds good, your connection here.
What happened first, and I'm sorry to drag this out, but I was a writer.
We really need 3 hours, but you're not getting it.
Come on. I started out writing short stories.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, I actually sold one.
Uh-huh.
And it was the Writer magazine, which was terrific.
Which is still around.
Yeah. And I think it was called A Number to Remember. And I have read it since, years ago, and it's terrible. I don't know why they bought it.
Uh-huh.
But for my abilities at that time, it was that. So at SC, I encountered a group of students who called themselves the Bards, and they dragooned me into joining them. I don't know why. And I'm not being falsely modest. I truly didn't understand, but I had a series of very lucky encounters. And the
Bards. Were there any big names in the Bards?
Not big names, but people who did a lot. There was our far left guy who was in charge of articles for our first copy. It's called Copy Magazine. I thought the title was terrible because it sounded like we were copying things instead of copy they meant as journalists mean it. And so we came out. I was the editor.
Yeah.
They made me the editor. I have no idea why. I just don't argue with people if they're going to, lift me up.
And
we made the front, with our first and only issue, we made the front page of the New York Times Sunday Book Review. And it was because my friend was Russell J. Burton. He was a little older. He had a blonde wife. We used to stand around his kitchen, jaws agape.
I don't know many people who've done that. Not many people at all.
Yeah, and I didn't think this was going to be easy, but I thought this is just amazing to me. But Russ,
I never thought of it. So you were in publication first.
Right.
Okay.
Well, eventually, after graduation.
That left you into screenplays? Screenplays?
No, not for a while yet.
Okay.
I needed a job.
Yeah.
I had graduated. And in fact, I remember with my parents, they said, "Oh my God, you're going to be a writer? How are you going to be a writer? You can't make a living as a writer." And I said, I don't care. I shall never teach. They said, "At least be a teacher." And I said, no way. I'm not going to teach.
So, incidentally, he teaches these days. But go on.
Yeah, well, not much. The conference is pretty much
Well, we'll
not.
Talk about it. We may get to that. But
okay.
But I want to talk about your accomplishments. I'm trying to get your accomplishments there.
Well, I've got a lot of novels published. I mean, a half dozen. That's a lot.
And there was one called The Collaborator, which somehow you...
The Collaborator supported me for a number of years because it kept getting options.
Option by...
One option after another option. But it always fell apart. I don't
know. I used to accuse Barney of that same thing. I mean, Barnaby, had that bullfighting book, and that he had options his whole life, I think. And the movie was never made.
Book. It's so tenuous. Today, it's tenuous. So you just count your lucky stars if you sell anything anywhere. Well, as an example, I did a play called, today it's called Dial 146.
Murder!
Sex Talk.
Oh.
And it originally called The Way Out, and it was a businessman who was harassed and very lonely man, you discover in the course of things. The days of the answering services.
Uh-huh.
And he and the answering service girl begin to have a dalliance, not together, but on the phone.
Oh.
And the staging of this was done by a dear friend since passed named Charles Rome Smith, who had been the dog in some play in New York. He barked off scene, did a lot of plays. He and I took two of, this was Chuck Smith's idea, took two of Ray Bradbury's short stories. And turned it into a play.
Uh-huh.
Chuck would walk up and down and say, well, this happened, that happened. And I said, okay. And I would write the dialogue. And that play, I thought was terrific. It was called Next in Line. It was about a couple trying to repair a marriage and finding themselves under witchcraft thing. It was Bradbury stuff.
Is it still worth doing, reviving? Or?
Well, writers will always tell you they think it's worth reviving.
But it was Ray's material, essentially?
It was Ray's. The stories were Ray's, but we put it into play for
Incidentally,
him.
He was very important in terms of Ray's involvement. You were very much important in Ray's involvement with the Writers Conference, the Santa Barbara Writers Conference.
Well, that
you
was...
You got him there every year... through rain, snow, sleet, and everything else.
Well, it was strange.
A very close relationship.
Yes, it was. We were dear friends. And I met him because of this copy magazine I told you about.
Uh-huh.
After the first issue went out, and in spite of the New York Times book review, essentially nobody had any interest in it. And someone said, we need some important writers to enhance us, to give us material for the magazine. And I said, we don't know any important writers. And they said, yes, we do. And I said, who? And they said, Ray Bradbury. I said, who?
Did he know who he was?
No.
Oh, my God.
Because he was a fantasy sci-fi
yes,
writer.
Yes, of course. And it was a whole other area there.
So we go to his house, and we hit it off, and Ray rode a bicycle everywhere, and he told people that he didn't like to drive.
And didn't like to fly, too.
He eventually did fly.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, he drank quite a bit, and they poured
him on. Oh, they put him on the plane? So
yeah.
Okay.
That was for Disney World, in order for him to go to Disney World. Anyway, I'm trying to speed this up.
Okay, all right, good, okay.
So we go over to his house, and... we meet each other, and I discover he needs somebody to drive him around, and because we both loved writing, and he discovered I was a writer, which didn't save me from a dreadful moment, by the way. I finished a novel, and I don't even remember what it was called, and I brought it over to Ray's, and we made an appointment for a couple days later, and I show up, and I said, well... What did you think? And he said, burn it.
Oh!
the man who, against burning books and all
that. That's funny.
Well, I was devastated.
As you should be.
And he said, okay. He saw that the blood was pooling around my feet. And he said, put it away and start over, but know that you'll have it there to do it. And so I was offered. But through Ray, I met people like Christopher Isherwood, Gerald Hurd, Aldous Huxley, who had a Vedanta thing going, and led me to...
The big geniuses in those days.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I drove Ray to Squaw Valley for the Squaw Valley Writers Conference. We met Barney and a number of other people. And we were in someone's workshop. I'm not going to demean the workshop, except it was so terminally boring that we staggered out, just beside ourselves. And Ray turns to me and he said, that settles it, Sid. You've got to teach. What I didn't know is Barnaby Conrad had already talked to Ray about keynoting, and that was at the Kate School in Santa Barbara. And
so you were there at the beginning.
Niels Mortensen and I and Barney and maybe one other person, I'm not sure, were the only workshop leaders.
Uh-huh.
And so,
I can't think of how many years ago that was. Anyhow, and you're still doing it because we've got the Writers' Conference coming up shortly.
June 7th. Yeah.
And Karen is going to do your workshop with you.
She is going to do it with me. She is smart
sort of
and so talented.
I think she sort of likes you.
You do? I'm glad to hear it.
Okay, let's go back because you're there. I bring up Charles Block, because Charlie Block is the one that introduced me to you. Charles Block worked for Bantam, my publishing company, and he was like the finder of talent.
Well, here's what happened there.
Okay.
Ray introduced Russ, who, by the way, this left winger eventually became Ronald Reagan's guy driving him everywhere when Reagan was first running to become the Republican candidate for president.
Uh-huh.
This far left winger.
Oh, wow.
In a good way, left wing. Just loved the man.
Uh-huh.
He was so charming. Half the people in Hollywood who were politically opposed to Reagan liked the man so much.
Oh, okay.
So I lost track.
Well, we're still talking about.
So here's a group of writers, all of whom have appeared in the best short stories of 19 blah blah.
Okay.
And one of them was a man named Jack Gus, and Jack Gus heard me reading from what became The Collaborator, and he said, "Sid, would you mind if I showed this to my people? That you don't know this, but I'm a scout for Charles Block." Who was a scout for...
Right, for Bantam.
For Bantam,
right.
Which had deals with Random House.
Right.
So something's helping my lucky streaks, but...
So just being around, you met somebody who led you to somebody else to... So you were really weren't in control of your creative life. Other people were pushing you in those directions.
Well, I was always writing.
Yeah, I guess so.
And
because you did, I noticed that you did a Henry Fonda. You did a play for Henry Fonda.
I did one. My agents at the time liked me because my stuff was getting some attention, and things were being optioned and one thing and another. And what was the question?
I was talking about theater. Henry Fonda. You did a play for Henry Fonda.
So one of the agents that my agent was friendly with had heard that Fonda wanted to do a play, a play where he toured.
Uh-huh.
And somehow, my wife always claims that I always think things are what they should be instead of what they actually
are.
Not
what they are.
And I thought he was saying, because he was estranged from his son, that he wanted to do, he and his son, Peter, to do a
traveling
show
together. Uh-huh.
So I came up and found father and son set pieces in English literature, American literature.
So it'll be an evening of set pieces of father-son stuff.
It turned out I'd misheard it, and Fonda, whose wife said he's very fond of you. My wife claims it's a thing, but he's fond of you. And I admired him enormously. Uh-huh. He was a complete professional.
It
went on, and he toured. He went back to, I forget what university that he graduated from.
Oh, was that early in his career?
Well, no, he was middle-aged at that point.
Oh, he was? Okay. All right, you're right.
And he said, "Sid, they stood up and cheered me." Uh-huh. It was so moving. It was so... He said, it's me because of, I'm a Hollywood actor or some... No.
Well, but he did a lot of theater.
Well, he did do a lot of theater. He was always
one of the few big actors that did go back to Broadway.
That's true.
Right.
And so I said, Henry, I could never bring myself to call him Hank because I admired him so much. And he said, no, they stood up because it's me, the name actor. And I said, I was bold at that moment. I said, those kids wouldn't stand up for their own parents if their own parents did something remarkable, because it was a disaffected generation that was coming up. Uh-huh. But anyway, that was a terrific experience. And included there was a trip to Santa Barbara. We did our first show.
You opened out of town in Santa Barbara?
Yeah, it was a trial showing.
Okay, yeah. We call it opening out of town.
And then we went to some hotel, probably the Miramar, for drinks and dinner after. And someone said, "Sid, you're very depressed. What's wrong? You're very quiet. What's wrong?" And I said, "I'm depressed." And they said, "What? What is it?" And I said, "Well, I looked out at the audience and half of them were asleep during the play." And they laughed and they said, "This is Santa Barbara. Don't you know what that means? It's full of retirees." Oh. And it's a place they go to the theater. These are all important people, blah, blah, but think nothing of it. So it was very successful, but it was arduous for
you. So you also did screenplays.
I did screenplays.
But now I want to get to your teaching.
Okay.
Especially this book, which you sent me. This really is a very interesting. It's a interesting combination of a primer, and your life, not your life story so much as your personality. Through it, I was very much impressed with a lot of the stuff you've got in there.
Oh well, thank you.
And I made a couple of notes of things that I did want to ask you about. You mentioned at some point you're talking about a series of books, and you mentioned the lottery. Shirley Jackson, that I forgot was my favorite book of all time. That you should know, Shirley Jackson's The Lottery.
Yes.
But it established something, even though I had worked with you, it really touched me that we had the same interests or the same kind of interest.
Taste, yeah.
Then there was, in your book, you talk about the difference between mystery and suspense. Talk a little bit about that. How do you explain that?
Gee, I said that?
Yes, you said that.
Well, I think all books should be suspenseful.
Yeah.
Mysteries have more or less a design pattern. Somebody commits a heinous act.
Yeah.
And the police or know everybody or something, some interesting character. Solve, maybe private eye, whatever it is. So mystery is something that has to be found out about. Suspense can be any kind of novel.
Uh-huh.
Every novel should be suspenseful.
I agree.
What I say.
But I think of also in terms of mystery. There are now so many variations of a mystery. That never used to be so. When you think about the writers writing today, going back to Agatha Christie, which did the traditional English stuff, and now you have people like Joe Nesbo doing stuff in foreign lands, foreign languages. I'm amazed that that whole category of publishing has blossomed so. And there's, now women in distress and all that kind of stuff seems to me is going on more and more today.
Well, that to repeat myself and just maybe waste time.
No, go
there's
on.
Not an, every novel should be thrilling and suspenseful.
Yeah,
now,
I agree.
And in order to find the category, there's blood and guts and terror and fear.
It could be even more
revenge.
Subtle. It could even be more subtle than that.
Yes, it can.
Right.
But
I mean, the number one book in America today is called "The Girl on the Train." Have you read it?
No, it's a great title.
It's a great title, and the idea is great. But the woman who is on every day going on this train in England, seeing the same people and peeking in the windows of things going on the way, and the results of it. It takes you patience to get through it, but the payoff is very, very good.
Mm.
It's Gone Girl, which was the big success a couple years ago. I don't know if you ever saw the movie.
Yes.
But again, a wonderful change of a big surprise. Suspense all the way, but a big surprise. Anyhow, That happens to be my area of interest, and that's the reason I did ask you that.
Did you know I was the crime and suspense critic for the LA Times
for
a number of years?
No, tell
Followed
me.
Which, when the editor left the Times and went to the Herald Examiner, at the LA Times my column was called Thrill Seeking, and with the Herald Examiner I changed the title to I Spy.
Do you have collections of those? And what did you did you reviewed crime books? All
yeah,
of them.
I wrote.
Was that how
I
you
wrote a
lottery?
Sunday, oh, really? Sunday, and a story I'm not going to tell you is how I almost became the editor of the LA Times Book Review.
Oh.
But it didn't work because of a stupid falling out I had with Bob Kirsch, who was the book editor.
Oh.
And fantastic book editor, read a novel a day. And actually could prove
Bob
that he...
Bob Kirsch did?
Yeah.
I noticed that Tom Boyle just got the Robert Kirsch Award last week for his writing.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right, he was a very, very interesting columnist.
Yeah.
So you at one point with, oh, you could do that now, you could blog stuff,
Oh, I need to...
Are you working on anything now?
I am.
I mean, besides still plugging this book.
Well, I don't plug the book. I had it. This book was a gift to me. I'll tell you how.
What do you mean it was a gift?
After, well, weeks of years go by.
Yeah.
And maybe the sixth or seventh year that I did the conference.
Uh-huh.
I've done all but one when I was in Australia. And this woman comes up to me at the end of the week and hands me a sheaf of papers. I said, "What's this?" She said, "This is everything you said in this workshop this week." She was a shorthand.
Oh? Not taping it, but she just did it by shorthand.
By shorthand.
Wow.
So I had it translated, and the guts of the book...
Was this?
Was this. And then, of course, I had to sit down and actually polish it and write it and think through stuff.
Well, it sort of gives a sort of a light look at biography of you, of various things you do. But I thought interesting was that was also the screenplay comments that you made.
Yeah, well,
is that what your workshop is like? What is your workshop like?
My workshop is not about screenplays. We have a screenwriter.
Yeah, a very good
teacher. My workshop's about how to protect yourself from being influenced in ways, in other words, how to isolate your own feelings and mind and concentrate on the writing and tap into your subconscious for that needed assistance when you don't know what's going to happen next. You want a brief sample?
Yes, give me a brief sample.
Okay. You're a writer. You've run out of steam, allegedly. You're even talking about writers.
I tell you, I did it. I got three pages. I could do no more than three pages.
All right.
And we're almost out of time.
Okay.